Okay, so welcome to Perimeter Institute's Black Hole Science Cafe. Okay, so the idea of these sessions is to introduce you to some of the amazing wonders and mysteries of our incredible universe and invite you to share in some of the really exciting research that's happening at the cutting edge, the forefront of knowledge today. Okay, so the title of our session today is Our Quirky Quantum World. Okay, so basically, for the first half of our session, I'm going to be up here talking, and I'm going to be introducing you to some really, really freaky aspects of our universe. Okay, I'm just going to basically totally blow your mind as to how our universe is. And you're going to be going like, huh? Like, is that really possible? How does that work? And all that stuff. You're going to have all kinds of questions. Okay, and fortunately, we have with us today a very special guest who will be able to answer all of those questions. So I'm delighted that we have with us today a world-leading expert in our quirky quantum world. That's Professor Raymond Laflamme, who is the director of the Institute for Quantum Computing on the University of Waterloo campus. And he's also an associate here at Perimeter Institute, specializing in quantum information. Okay, so let's have a warm welcome for Professor Laflamme. All right. So, are we ready to enter the black hole and have a mind-warping experience? Ah! All right. Okay. So, the first thing I want to say is very simple, and that is that the world is quantum. Okay? What does that mean? What exactly is quantum? How many of you have talked a little bit about quantum in school? Okay, a few of you. Okay, so you're going to learn a whole lot about quantum here. It's very, very cool. I'm basically going to tell you three things that you need to know about quantum. Okay, so the first is that quantum is essential to our existence. We can't live without it, and I'm going to tell you why. The second is quantum is unbelievably quirky, strange, weird, bizarre. We've known about it for about 100 years now, but we have still not been able to wrap our minds around what it's really saying. It's very weird. Nevertheless, we've been able to put quantum to use. Quantum is powerful. It empowers all kinds of technologies that we have today that we use in everyday life. I'll talk about that. And it's going to empower some really incredible, real 21st century, almost science fiction-like technologies that you can help develop. Okay? You're basically right in at the ground floor of this thing called the quantum information age. I'm going to tell you a lot about that, and that's part of why you're here, to hear about that. All right, so are we ready to go? Yeah! Okay, so the first thing I want to say is this is a picture of the atom as it was understood in around 1911. It shows electrons orbiting around the nucleus of an atom, just like planets orbit around the sun. For how many of you is this your kind of mental picture of how the atom works? Okay, so a few of you. Okay. Well, sadly, this is actually totally wrong. Okay. So what I would like to do is spend a few minutes talking about what's wrong with this picture. Okay, so first off, the electron obviously can't be standing still. Okay, so we've got a positively charged nucleus and a negatively charged electron. Opposites attract. Okay, if we had the electron at rest like that and released it, well, it would just snap into the nucleus. It would just fall into the nucleus. Okay, and the atom would collapse, and the world as we know it would cease to exist. That would be bad, right? Okay, so somehow the electron needs to be moving. Okay, so for a clue, if we can look at the Earth in its motion about the sun. Okay, the Earth is also attracted to the sun, in this case by gravity, but it doesn't just get sucked into the sun. And that's because it has some sideways motion here. Okay? So it's natural to imagine that the electron in the atom is doing something the same. Okay? It's also just orbiting around the nucleus of the atom, just like the Earth orbits around the sun. Okay, so that seems reasonable, right? How many say, yeah? Only a few now, because you know something's up, right? Okay, it turns out that the difference between the electron and the Earth is that the electron has electric charge. And in motion like that, it would radiate electromagnetic radiation, radio waves and light. That's basically how a cell phone works, electrons jiggling around, radiate electromagnetic waves. The difference is in a cell phone, there's a battery to power those waves. In the atom has only its electron. Okay, so in powering those waves that it's radiating, it would deplete the energy of the electron. And what would actually happen is, very quickly, the electron would spiral into the nucleus. Okay, and the atom would collapse, and again, the world as we know it would cease to exist. Okay, so the electron can't be standing still, nor can the electron be moving. In both cases, the atom would very quickly collapse in a flash of light. Very bad. And basically what that says is we can't seem to find, it seems to be inescapable. We can't seem to escape from the fact that basically all matter in the universe should collapse in a blinding flash of light. Because I'm looking around and, well, that's not happening. Okay, so something about our thinking is incorrect. Okay, and so this is where quantum is going to come in. Okay, so let's just back up here. So the electron we know can't stand still, and the electron can't move. So the big question is, well, so what's it doing? Okay, we know that this is impossible. Okay, but we also know that this is stupidly impossible. Okay, there's no way that's happening, right? So let's just stick with the merely impossible and try to fix it. Okay, so that's the picture of the electron as a particle orbiting around the nucleus. Okay, what if instead of a particle rotating around, the electron could somehow smear itself out into a rotating ring? Okay, smear itself out all around its orbit so that it was like a rotating ring. Okay, so if you look at that picture, what we see is it's moving. It's still moving around, keeping it from falling in, but it appears to be standing still. If you took snapshots of that electron, of that rotating ring, all those snapshots would look identical. It would just look static. Okay? And if some of you know a little bit about magnetism, you might recognize that a rotating ring of charge like that would produce a magnet, a magnetic field. And in fact, that's how magnets work. Okay? Atoms inside magnets are doing that sort of thing, but more in a weirder sort of way, as we'll see in a minute. Okay? But the crucial point here is that nothing is dynamical. Nothing is changing. Okay? And so it just appears to be standing still, so there's no radiation. Okay, so it would seem as if this rotating ring of charge solves our problem, right? How many say, problem solved, yeah. Okay, now you're getting really leery of this. Okay, so it turns out that, of course, the problem is not solved. And how it's not solved is really, really interesting. Okay, so it turns out that whenever we actually look for the electron, so here's this atom, and then we look for the electron with little detectors and so on, what we find is that the electron, it instantly appears, what instantly appears is a whole electron, either here or there. Okay, never just parts of an electron. We never see like a ring of charge, or we never detect, say, just half an electron. Okay, so for example, if we look right now, we might see, boom, a whole electron over there. Or if we look now, we might see a whole electron over there. Or now, a whole electron over there. Okay, we never see just part of an electron. Okay, so it doesn't seem to be smeared out like this in any literal sort of sense. Okay, so here's where it gets really quirky. Here's where quirky quantum enters. Okay, so turns out that whenever we're not looking at the atom, the electron exists in this really weird sort of ghostly kind of state, okay, and where in which it's nowhere definite at any instant of time, and it's potentially anywhere. Okay, so what I mean is, at this instant of time right now, it's not definitely there, but it could potentially be there. Okay, at this instant of time now, it's not definitely there, but it could potentially be there. Or now, it's not definitely there, it could potentially be there. Okay, so and that's true at all points around its orbit. So the electron exists in this really weird sort of ghostly state in which it is essentially everywhere at once. So it's not literally smeared out, okay, in a simple sort of way, but it's effectively smeared out. Okay, and that whole sort of ghostly state of the electron is of course rotating. Okay? So just to sort of sum up here, whenever we're not looking at the atom, the electron appears to be behaving like a ghost. Okay? If there's anything ghostly in our universe, this is it. It's inside the atom. Okay? Now, this is a picture of the ghost going clockwise, going right. Okay? And of course, the ghost can also go the other way around, right? So that's a picture of the ghost going left, the other way around. Now, here's something really cool that is just going to blow your mind. It turns out that the electron can exist in this sort of super ghostly state in which it is simultaneously going right and left. Okay? So it's rotating both ways at the same time, and so it's not really rotating. Are you cool with that? That seemed like a believable thing? Okay, well, so that's the idea. That's the quirkiness of quantum, okay? An example of the quirkiness of quantum. And actually, a lot of you will be familiar with this picture in a different guise. Okay, so how many of you have seen this kind of a picture of the atom? Okay, showing electron orbitals. You've probably seen this in chemistry, right? These are electron orbitals. But whenever you see an electron orbital, you should realize that what's going on is this really ghostly state in which the electron is effectively everywhere at once. Okay? It's a very, very strange state. And in fact, there are lots of strange ghostly states that the electron can be in. And this is a list of some of them. And you'll recognize these from chemistry, the quantum numbers from chemistry, right? Okay. Anyways, so far we've learned that that atoms, which of course make up you and me, can't exist in a sort of common sense universe in which the electron can be at any instant of time here or there or there. Okay, but atoms can exist in a quirky quantum universe in which the electron can be here and here and here all at the same time. Or, in fact, can be, say, rotating right and left at the same time. So the basic difference between our everyday experience with the world is, in our everyday experience with the world, things are either this or this. A switch is on or off, that sort of thing. In the quantum world, the world inside the atom and subatomic particles and so on, that small scale, nature's very different. Okay? And multiple things can be happening simultaneously. It's very, very freaky. Okay, so. So the ghost first appeared to us in around 1925. Okay? And at first, we were afraid. Okay? And then, but we got used to the ghost. We got more friendly with the ghost. And in fact, now we're quite good friends with the ghost. And in fact, we've been able to put the ghost to work for us. All right? So what are some of the ways in which we've done that? Well, first of all, how many of you recognize that device? What is that? Yeah. Yeah, that's a semiconductor. It's a transistor. This device is one of the most important technologies to have been developed in the past 100 years. Okay? And that device works because electrons inside that transistor are able to behave in a ghost-like way. So there's a ghost inside each transistor. Okay? And transistors, of course, are powering things like computers. Okay, everything from a laptop computer to desktop computers to supercomputers, which are able to simulate global climate change or, in fact, simulate the evolution of the entire universe from the Big Bang to the present. So computing technology is hugely useful for human beings. Okay, also, there's a transistor inside every cell phone. Okay, so transistors power the communication age. The transistors are virtually everywhere. The power of the ghost, you know, empowers basically every electronic device on the planet. Okay, so that would seem like an important application of the ghost, right? Okay, so another important application is with lasers. Okay, so that's laser light. This beautiful pure light is also pure ghost. Okay, so laser light is you know, going through fiber optic cables, transmits a lot of internet traffic today. Okay, so in a sense, the ghost powers the web, you know, powers Google. Okay, lasers are also used. The most powerful laser in the world is being used to spark artificial suns, attempt to spark artificial suns, fusion, and help solve the world's energy problems. Okay, so it's hugely useful. Of course, many other applications like your DVD player, Blu-ray, laser printers, laser surgery use in medicine, lasers used in industry, like in the first example there for welding and that sort of thing. Okay, so the laser and the transistor and just quantum in general has become extremely useful to humanity, all kinds of everyday technologies. Okay, but the fact is, we've only just begun. Okay, so this picture of the transistor, that's a transistor when it looked like, you know, in the 1960s. Okay, so one transistor was about a half a centimeter in size. Okay? But human technology has evolved to such an extent in terms of miniaturization, we've been able to construct transistors that are very, 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 very tiny, okay, and pack them densely on computer chips. So here is a computer chip, which is about maybe the size of your thumb. And on that chip, there are essentially billions of transistors. Okay? And each of those transistors is very, very tiny, about 100 atoms in size. Okay, so technology has become so powerful, we're able to manipulate matter at very, very, very small scales. Okay, that's just commercial. If you go to physics laboratories where the real high technology is, you will find people manipulating atoms or manipulating matter at the level of individual atoms. Okay, so this is an ion trap, and in it you see on the left-hand side a single atom, two atoms, three atoms, and so on. So human beings are now able to manipulate matter at the level of individual atoms. It's really quite amazing. Okay, and remember, atoms are exactly where the ghost lives. Okay, so what that means is that we have come, technology has brought us face to face with the ghost. And this is really cool. What's happening, it's sparking an entirely new era of technology, okay? An era called the quantum information age. And you guys happen to be born just at a time where you are right at the ground floor of this quantum information age. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is tell you about some of the technologies which might be coming down the pipe. And they are very, very cool. All right, so the first one, I'm going to tell you about three of them. The first one is called quantum cryptography. Okay, so here's the basic idea. We've got Alice and Bob. And so Bob, you know, oh, Alice, you're the one for me. But Bob, in a quantum world, how can we be sure? Okay, so they're transmitting some message that they would like to be secret between them. Okay, so how do they do that? With ordinary cryptography, what they would do is Bob would encode the message at his end, transmit it over to Alice, and Alice would decode the message or decrypt it. Okay? But of course, in the real world, there's always an evil Eve, okay, who's going to want to be eavesdropping on that message. Okay? And if Eve is clever enough, she will be able to decipher the message, and the secrecy will be lost. Okay, so here's where we employ the ghost, the quantum ghost. The quantum ghost is able to detect eavesdroppers. And so what has resulted is this amazing communication technology, which is absolutely secure. Okay, the absolute security is ensured by the very quantum laws of nature itself. The world has never seen anything like this before. You can imagine there's huge interest in this from organizations like banks, governments, military. It's a really, really big deal. Okay, there's a lot of resources being invested in developing this kind of technology. Okay, so right now, prototypes of this technology already exist. And coming up in the future, what people are looking towards is an absolutely secure global satellite quantum communication network. This is way cool. It would look something like this. Okay? And in a sense, the ghost is now, you know, in space. It's very 21st century technology. All right, the next technology I want to mention is quantum teleportation. So let's see. So the idea here is you've got an atom that's over here, and you've got an atom that's over there in two different states. Okay, and the atom that's over here is in some sort of ghostly state like this. The idea of quantum teleportation is to teleport that ghost from the atom on the left to the atom on the right. And so this is done using some fancy laser technology and so on. And at the end of the day, it's possible to teleport the ghost of one atom into another atom and put that atom in exactly the same ghostly state. And in the process, it sort of randomizes the state of the first atom. I don't want to get into the details of that. But at the end of the day, basically, we now have the technology to move the ghost from here to here. It's like really, really creepy. This is Asher Peres is one of the people involved in this quantum teleportation. And when a journalist who was thinking, you know, towards the future, can we teleport human beings, all that kind of stuff, right, asked him, you know, can we teleport not only the body, but also the soul, and his reply was, only the soul. Okay? Because it's just the quantum information or the quantum state which you're transporting, not the matter itself. It's very, very freaky technology. All right, so now, in case you don't believe that this actually exists, there it is. That's a quantum teleportation machine. That you're looking at is super high technology. Okay, and a third technology I want to talk, just mention a little bit about, is quantum computing. So the idea here is we want to somehow harness this this quantum magic, quote unquote, and use it to empower computers and bring them to the next level. They get a new kind of computer that just is like super, super powerful. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, let's look at a simple computer, very, very simple. So the idea here is there's just two inputs on the left-hand side, and what the computer does is it multiplies those two numbers, and it spits out the output on the right-hand side. Okay, with an ordinary computers use numbers 0 or 1. Okay, so at the inputs, you can have either a 0 or a 1. Okay, so for example, if you've got two zeros at the input, 0 times 0 is 0. Okay, or 0 times 1 is 0. Or 1 times 0 is 0. Or 1 times 1 is 1. Okay, so the point is there are four possible combinations of inputs. And that computer, ordinary computers, can only process those inputs one at a time. Okay, but then people started thinking, well, can we actually do something more? Can we do something really, really cool? Okay, we know that we can put an atom in this state in which the ghost goes to the right, rotates clockwise. We could use that to represent a zero. We can put the atom in a state where the ghost goes to the left, which would represent a one. Okay, but what can an atom do? Both ways. It can go both ways. We can put it in this super ghost state in which it's going right and left at the same time, which means our 0 and 1, it's not 0 or 1, it's 0 and 1 at the same time. Okay, so this is amazing. Okay, so that means that instead of an or 0 or 1, we can have 0 and 1. So at the input, at one input, we can have this weird sort of ghostly state in which it's simultaneously 0 and 1, same at the other input. So what it means is that basically all inputs, all four possibilities, are present simultaneously. And the computer is able to process those inputs simultaneously. It's like a quantum parallel computer. Okay, this is a bit of a simplification, oversimplification of the whole thing. But I think it gets across the gist of the idea that the quantum computer is able to do things, multiple things simultaneously. It's a kind of quantum parallelism. And so the hope is that this will provide some kind of exponential boost in computing power for certain tasks. Okay, so the fact is that such quantum computers actually already exist. And there's one of them. And in fact, there's Ray Laflamme next to his quantum computer at the Institute for Quantum Computing. Okay, I'll let him talk about that that device there. So it's a prototype of a real working quantum computer. It is absolutely amazing. Okay, so there are two main questions that researchers are now trying to answer in this field of quantum computing. And these are the kinds of questions that you may wish to focus your attention on in the future. Okay, it's very, very cool. The first question is, first of all, what can a quantum computer do? Okay, it can't just do anything. What we know now is just a few tasks that it can do. For example, certain kinds of sorting tasks. Okay, what we really want to know is what is the full range of possibilities for this potentially exponential increase in computing power. The second big question is, well, how do we build one? Okay, well, there's one right there, okay, but that's just a small prototype. The idea is, around the world, there's this huge competition amongst various different technologies, finding a technology to build a quantum computer that can be scaled up to a large quantum computer, okay, one that would be really useful, and one that would far exceed the computing power of any supercomputer on the planet today. Okay, so we're looking for a technology that can be scaled up. Okay, so those are the two big questions with quantum computing. So, very, very exciting stuff. And let me just sort of wrap up by reminding you here. So quantum is what? First of all, it's essential to our existence. We can't live without it because atoms can't exist without it. It's super quirky, very, very weird, this whole ghostly sort of thing. And third is it's very, very powerful. Okay, it powers a lot of technologies that we have today and is going to power really, really cool futuristic technologies coming down the pike. Okay, so in short, quantum is the future. All right, so, let's turn it over to a question and answer. a question and answer period with Ray LaFlamme. So Ray, do you want to come over here? And we'll just sort of switch off the mics here.
Questions. I'll turn my BlackBerry off because it interferes with the microphone somewhat.
One of the common examples of the power of quantum computing is the ability to use something like Shor's algorithm to factor.
My goodness.
Which would obviously be devastating to classical cryptography. How close are we in terms of time to a quantum computer that would be able to be an effective implementation of Shor's algorithm such that it could be used to break modern cryptography in a matter of minutes or seconds?
Wow, I'm impressed by that question. I was expecting something on a very basic level. So who around here have heard about Shor's algorithm, except this guy? What? So I'll put the question into a context. So one of the applications of quantum computer is to break cryptography codes. So cryptography cryptology is the science of making information secure when you want to move it from one place to the other. And for years and years and years and years, human beings have been trying to find methods to encrypt information so that securely you can transfer from one place to the other. Initially, in fact, there's some story about the Queen of Scotland, Queen Mary, I think, had a very vague idea of cryptography, and she was sending some messages. She was captive from some bad king, and she was sending some secret messages to people who were trying to kind of overthrow the king. And she thought the information was going to be secure. Turns out that the king had a better cryptography. They broke the code. And they decided that the poor queen had to go, and indeed. So cryptography is very important, or was important in the 17th century, but it's still important during history. We see it most often in the 18th, 19th century related to military conquest of one place to the other, how does an army talks to every part of its own army without having somebody who kind of eavesdrop in the middle or know about the messaging. But in the last probably 20, 25 years, it has become something that everybody uses. So I would bet that probably most of you has used some cryptography probably in the last 24 hours or probably in the last week. So if you go on the internet and you are either buying something or if you want to exchange information that nobody wants or you don't want somebody to break in your website or your Facebook, it's all based on cryptography. And especially on the exchange of information through, if you buy something on the internet, the basic way that this works is through a mathematical problem called factoring. So if I give you 50 and I ask you to factor it, you will give me the answer?
5 and 5 and 2.
5 and what?
5 and 5 and 2. Prime factor 50.
You factor 50. You multiply two numbers, you get 50.
Okay, so get 5. You can do 5 and 10 or 25 and 2 or
5 and 3, right?
15.
Oh,
15.
That's my English. That's my, well, my French. So I'll put it. So if you want to factor 15, obviously it's 5 times 3. That one is easy. 2071. This one I don't know. I think it's 24,001, which is 73 by 37. So it's a bit harder. And the harder, the bigger the number, becomes harder and harder and harder and harder. And it turns out that if you count the number of digits, so this one I think is 241. If I'm not, I think that's okay. If you count the number of digits of the number you want to factor, and you say how much time a computer that we have, these kind of computers, I'll call them classical computers, to make a distinction from quantum computers. How much resource do you need to factor a number like this? So you look at what is the time as a function of number of digit. And it turns out that it's exponential. So that goes up incredibly fast. So exponential, you know what it is. So if I say 10 to the power of this. So the algorithm to factor, it turns out it goes like the exponential. So you know the number e, right? E is 2.41 something. So it's exponential of the number of digit, and there's a number which is about one there. So it goes up, and its number of digits is about one. So it goes very fast like this. So it turns out that if the number is large enough, then it's nearly impossible for a classical computer on Earth to solve it. So if you use Explorer or I'm a Mac person, so I use Safari. The typical number of digit that you will use when you log into, I don't know, when you guys log into, like me, I log into either my bank or kind of Canadian Tire or something like that. Abercrombie and Fitch or something like that. I was in New York with my daughter in December, so I learned some of these phrases. So if I look at the number of digits, it's about 128. And you can go and calculate how long does it take, and most people will not be able to do this. One thing that quantum computers are incredibly good at is to factor these numbers. If I would give this a quantum computer, it would be very fast. So if that one with 128 digits, instead of being an exponential, it's a polynomial. So it's the number of digits, let's say 2. In fact, it's the power of cube. And if I make a plot like this, initially for small, small number, it might be a little bit harder, but it doesn't grow very much. It goes like this. So happens much, much slower, faster for quantum computers. So this is the quantum computer. This is the classical computer. And this is to factor a number or to break a cryptography code. So this gentleman was asking about the algorithm on quantum computers to factor. This is called Shor's algorithm. Peter Shor was a researcher at AT&T. And he discovered this in 1994. And in fact, there's a funny little story about this. Because many codes that we have today, a large fraction, are related to factoring or a friend's problem or a cousin of that problem. So the agency in the world who are looking for cryptography in Canada is the CSE, the Communications Security Establishment, and the US is the NSA, the National Security Agency, who are kind of checking to be sure that nobody are breaking these codes. So roughly every day they receive some paper from somewhere of somebody who found a way to break the codes or kind of factor. And they always wrong. So it's like another crank paper angle. And suddenly they got this paper from this guy called Peter Shor. And so they look at this and they didn't know what quantum computers were. So they discuss it, okay, but they have to be ensure the government that these codes are secure. So they kind of check out this one. And who's that guy? So they go on the internet and check who's that guy, Peter Shor. He had done undergrad in Caltech and a grad studies at MIT, so he was not totally crazy. So he said, no, I don't know, we should take it serious. And he started to look at it, and indeed, he had an algorithm to factor. Now, the great thing for them, they were happy because they didn't have the machine called quantum computer yet, but they started to say, oh my goodness, if these things happen, then we have to be very careful because the codes that we're using today could be broke tomorrow. And so they started a program to study this. In fact, I was in the US up to 2001 at this place called Los Alamos National Lab. And that's how I started to work in that area. In fact, I went to a conference. And in fact, I was not too keen to go on the conference because it was an area a little bit different than mine. But my boss at the time said, oh, there'll be some really cool people there. You should go. It'll be fun. And it was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it was a beautiful place. They said, oh, go. And I went to the conference, and there was this buzz in the conference of something important that happened. And that was Shor's algorithm. So learn about this. Now, to make all this story short and answer your question, when are we going to have a machine which breaks the code that we have today? The answer is, we don't know. And we don't know because we haven't built these machines yet. So we have a small prototype of quantum computers like the one you've seen. And when we say small, we really mean by small, it doesn't manipulate much quantum information. And so to break a code with Shor's algorithm, which will break the code that we're using today with kind of 128 digit, we would need about
a few thousand quantum bits. So you know what a bit of information is. Richard mentioned it. So it's a basic unit of information that you use is the zero or one. So remember, when you do send a message with your cellular phone, you have a string of zero and one. For example, that one translated in language of use means, I don't like that guy. Or maybe kind of written different ways, she's my Valentine for tomorrow. But you don't want this, so you want to use cryptography to be sure that nobody kind of spies on you. So when you communicate, you take a string of zero and one, you send it to somebody. When you want to compute, you take a string and you kind of use the transistors that Richard mentioned. This helps you to manipulate the string, you get another one. Saying, yes, that guy is really great. So this is what communication or communication is at the very fundamental mathematical level. It's manipulation of strings of zeros and ones. So each of these are represented by a bit. If we go in the quantum world, in the classical system, the bits of information are either in zero or one. So we really have a string like this. If we go in the quantum world, they can be in zero and one at the same time. So if I have one of them, it's not zero and one, but it's zero and one. So if we have two of them, we can be in zero, 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 one, one, zero, and one, one. If you have three of them, it could be in zero, 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 one, up to one, one, one. So the number of those is my quantum bits. Now, I'm getting the answer where you want to go. So the number of bits, the quantum bits that I need to factor numbers like this is about 10,000. Quantum bit. Quantum bits, they're a little bit long, so we call them qubits. So I need about 10,000 qubits to factor numbers that people are using today. The biggest quantum computer that we have on Earth right now has 12. So we're so far. How long does it take? We don't know. Maybe 20 years, maybe 30, maybe 40. And I'm very vague because this is new, this is research, we're trying to make these things happen. And when you have something which is new, when you do science, you cannot predict the result before you make, kind of build it. And that's what we're doing at the Institute for Quantum Computing, as we're trying to build these devices. There's about a dozen of technologies, of ways to think about how to build this. And sometimes one gets a little bit ahead of the other one, and then suddenly it slows down and the other one catch up, and that's the kind of things that we do. So I ended up with the answer. It was long for this, but there was not a nice story. Other questions? Yes?
This is like a much more simple question. And maybe I just missed something, but I don't understand why you said that the ghost, or the electron only behaves as a ghost when we're not looking. But what happens when we are looking?
Do you want to go?
I'm looking at the... I'm erasing so I can think about the answer. So when you look at the world around us, it has a set of rules that it obeys. Why it obeys these rules, we don't really understand. Sometimes we can find some more fundamental rules which explain some other rules. But there's two rules that Richard mentioned, like the ghost who can be in zero and one or turning one side or the other. It's called a superposition principle. And it's superposition because it can be in two states at the same time. Why is that? Why suddenly kind of this atom can, or this electron can turn this way and this way at the same time? Like, we're not thinking about two things. The same thing is kind of going in two completely different directions at the same time. We don't know. It just is that way. We do experiments, and the only way to understand these experiments is to think about these things to be in two different states of the same. The other property that Richard mentioned is the fact that when we measure, or I'll put a Q in front for quantum measure, it affects always
the quantum system. And so when we look at the rules of the mathematical part of the theory, we can see this. And physicists for the last 100 years have been trying to find some really smart and clever way to get around that rule, to test it, to check it out, to be sure that it's really kind of correct. And we can never find a way to measure without leaving some kind of fingerprint or affecting the system. So there's no way to really kind of understand it in the sense of it is a consequence of something else. It just is. So it's probably not a very satisfactory answer where I would have said, because of this, you will all. But it's just the laws of quantum mechanics. Just forget to learn something about the world, which is where you cannot affect the world around you. In the macroscopic world that we are right now, if I kind of turn around like this, people can keep looking at me and I don't know who's looking and who's not looking. In the quantum world, you can find out that people are stopping to look or not. And it is, so it's a fundamentally new thing. You cannot know anything about something of the world without affecting it. And so that's one of the interesting things that I love about this research in quantum information and quantum computing. There are elements which are essentially philosophical. Why is this? Like, why every time you measure it affects the world, and what are the implications of this? And there's a very practical side of it, like the cryptography one that we mentioned, use these properties to build a quantum cryptography system, which is important for secure information going from one place to the other. So you have a very wide range of implications. Other questions? No,
I just have, well, so you can use quantum computing to decrypt like 120-bit encryption or whatever. Yeah. Can you use it to like super encrypt something too?
That was what quantum cryptography was about.
Oh, okay.
So the idea of cryptography is if you want to exchange information between two people, you can do it by encrypting. So one way of encrypting is, like, a really easy way is, instead of using the letter A, use the letter B. If you use B, use C. And so you can make a more complex substitution. But that was what the Queen of Scots was using. So she was just using a transposition. It's not that hard to break. So do you get, anybody here knows how to break that code if you try this?
You just start rotating until you get a message that makes sense. You just
if you just do a translation, you're absolutely right. But if I would do, okay, this one is X, and X is Z, and M is F. So there it is. I would have foiled you. So the way that people, so this one turns out to be relatively easy, because if you go in any text, take a book at random, look at what is the probability of having E's. The probability of having A, B, C. And the English language, I think E is the letter which is most used. I think it's 17%. So you go and look at the message that somebody sent you, and you look at which letter happens the most often, and you'll know that this is an E. The second one, I think, is an A. And then you can go and look at this, and you can decode that way. So people started to think about more complex way of doing this. So that was one way. Another way that we can do encryption is, if you have a string like this, and you and me exchange a string. So we meet, and we have a string, and we are going to take a dice or a coin. And then if you get a tail, it's a zero, and a head, it's a one. So we make something which is random. And so this is the message. And this is one I'm going to call the key. What's your first name?
My name?
Yeah.
My name's Jeremy.
Perfect. So it makes it kind of more personal and kind of more real. So Ray has this key. And then Jeremy has left. We've met yesterday, we exchanged the key, and now he's in Moscow. Oh, yeah, he's key. And then suddenly I have my message. So I want to send him a message saying that he won in the lottery or something like this. So I can encrypt that using this by just adding these numbers. Or what I'm going to do is that if the letters are the same, I'm going to put a 0. And if they are different, I'm going to put a 1. So I put 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. It turns out that we can prove. I wonder if this has used cryptography to do that. So this is the encrypted message. And you can prove that if the key was random, this now looks completely random for anybody who tries to eavesdrop. So when things look completely random, there's no message in there. So I send this to Jeremy on the internet, and anybody can snoop. He gets it, but they cannot. They don't know what to do with this because these letters look completely random. But he gets it here, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. And then he does the same operation that I've done. So 1 and 1 give me 0. This give me 1. This give me 1, 1, 0, 1, 0. And suddenly, I haven't made any mistake, it's exactly the same message as this. And so this is an attempt, which is all the Vernon cipher. It was invented at the beginning of the 1920s, which is if you have a key which is shared between two people, which is completely random, you can send the information with 100% security. So you might say, so what do we do with this? Like, we're done? We have 100% security. Problem is this thing, is that Ray and Jeremy had to meet. So it was okay, Jeremy's here today. But what happened if tomorrow or in 10 days he's used that key once and then he wants to send another message? If it turns out that we can prove that if you use the same key again and again and again, you can use the status quo analysis that I mentioned and break the code. Because again, it doesn't look random anymore because the message will use exactly the same kind of letters, which happen more often, and use the same kind of transpiration. But you need a new key for every message you send. So today, when you have very important messages between different embassies in different countries, or different embassies of the same country, it's not that easy to break, you just open it. So if you exchange a message at a very, very high level of government, that's what they use. They still send, like the Canadian Foreign Office still send people to the Moscow embassy with a handcuff and a little suitcase. Like 21st century. Wake up, you guys. So what people have been trying to do in the 1970s and 1980s is to try to find something which replaces this completely random. Their idea was to use something which was called pseudo-random, something which looks pretty much random, but not totally random. And what is something which is pseudo-random? A mathematical problem that you cannot solve. So if the problem is hard enough, you haven't solved it, it looks random. So that was the factoring, that's how it came about. People were looking at that kind of thing. And now quantum computers break those. So they're not really pseudo-random if we would have a quantum computer. And so the idea of quantum cryptography, so one of the point in here is that when you send the key, in the classical world, you can never know if somebody has looked at it. If you just send the key through an email in the internet, all the routers that are along the way can stop and look at what is the key that you're sending. And you don't know. If you use your cellular phone, you don't know if somebody is eavesdropping or not. Like there's the old movies where you heard a double click or something like that. The old war movies where you kind of hear a double click at the end. But with today's technology, if somebody's eavesdropping on your cell phone, and in fact, if you are in the US, and you can hear this from the news, most telephone conversation between the US and foreign countries was eavesdropped by the National Security Agency because of 2001. And so, is there a way to make the thing without this problem of having an eavesdropper looking at it? And quantum cryptography is this. Not that you cannot prevent eavesdropping, but you can know when it happens. So you do send the key using a state of light between two people. In fact, if you go across this hall, in my office there, you'll see a telescope thing, and it is one of the prototypes of these quantum telegraphy system. And so you can exchange a key, and then you can check, sacrifice a whole piece of the key to know if somebody has eavesdropped. How did you do this? Well, you have the, suppose that we would have established, Jeremy and me, that key, and so on, that would be a one here. We can sacrifice a few of those, of these bits, to know if somebody is dropping. And if somebody is dropped, Richard says that it perturbs the answer. So a one will turn into a zero, or the zero goes into one. And you can find out if this has happened or not. And that technology of quantum cryptography is much nearer to realization than quantum computing. So there are prototypes of quantum cryptography which are working around the world, and a few companies who have products today. Yep.
Okay, so this might take quantum cryptography by definition is a point-to-point link where you, as I understand it, I have to send a message to you and then you can determine if it's been intercepted in between. But modern communications networks require on it being a network where I send a message to a router, which sends a message to another router, which sends a message to my bank. So how would you, because by definition, routers need to be able to view a portion of the message in order to forward the rest of the message to the appropriate destination. So how could you build a quantum cryptographic network without having a direct line to every single person with whom you might potentially want to communicate?
So one way is that you could, when you send the key, you could have a tag on it, which is a classical description. So the whole message would have a classical tag on it, which would say where you go through the router to go to point B. And then the rest would be a quantum state, which follows, which contains the information.
So you then still have to send the exact same particle along, because I mean, nowadays when a computer, when a router receives a message, it receives the message, it reads and then it sends the same message out, but it's actually different physical particles. Wouldn't a quantum router actually have to send the exact same particles out, or?
Yeah, so you have to change the router. So you have to make it, so you cannot use today's infrastructure. In fact, one of the things related to this is if you send light through optic fibers, at about every 20 to 30 kilometers, you have to have an amplifier who amplifies the signal again and kind of boost it and send it. And this, when you amplify a signal, you have to look at it and then you boost it. It's just that the fact of doing this will, oh, I erased the property here. You are going to destroy the quantum net and look like an eavesdropper. So you have to change all the routers around the world to make this quantum cryptography work. So do I worry about this, that we have to change all the routers in the world? No, because around 1990, nobody had cellular phones. And when people were mentioning cellular phones, they said, this will never happen. Can you imagine all the towers you would have to build so that you have coverage everywhere where you go? And then you look at it today, and it's incredible. So this is in the last 15 years, in fact, in the last 10 years, the number of towers that have grown, man, it's like mushrooms. Right? Yep.
Now you can understand that it's been tampered with the time. So when you're sending it from yourself to Jeremy, you can understand that it has been tampered with. Can you understand who's been tampering with it? Can you trace it back to the tampering?
No, you cannot. In fact, I should point out on this is that you realize that the key has been tampered. And so if you realize that the key has been tampered, you don't use it to encrypt the information and send it to somebody. When you learn that the key has not been tampered with, then you can use it. So that's one of the important points I had not mentioned. But you cannot know who did it and exactly how they do it. You need. So now I'm starting to think, maybe you would have to do it many times. Like if you realize that there is an eavesdropper, you don't know where it is, there might be a way to start to change the key that you're sending to try to find out where it happens and that kind of stuff. In fact, they do a little bit of this with optic fiber cables today. This is not quantum, but classical. Suddenly the optic cables break, and you want to know where it is, especially when it's under the sea, and you don't want to send a boat everywhere. So they send the light, and if it's broken, there will be a certain amount of reflection that comes in because of the break. And then from this, the time that it takes to go to the break and come back, you know what is the distance that you go from the break, and then the boat can go pretty much in the right direction where the thing is broken. So there might be some protocol to find where is the eavesdropper, what it's doing, but unfortunately, it doesn't come when it leaves a fingerprint. It doesn't leave. It's not a fingerprint in that sense that you know exactly who it is. It just left some effects at the end.
So it has been tampered with.
Yeah.
So it, for security, it's not so much. It's not so much that you can find out who's doing it and stopping it. It's just that you can choose different channels of communication.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So if you make it so secure, how would say law enforcement try to wiretap it?
Very good. In fact, so either you don't implement it perfectly, and so there's a backdoor that most people don't know about, so that's one way, or you just give up on the ability of the law enforcement to go and break it. So you can see that there will be resistance in government to implement this.
So basically, it's not perfect, because there's going to be people who are going to be against it, because there's things that you can't do anymore.
Yeah, so maybe I can ask that question to you guys. Or maybe you've thought about this or not. How important it is to have 100% security or privacy when you want it? So are there things that you think are really important to be private? Or you think that?
I agree that there's some things that are meant to be kept private, say like launch codes or something like that, something ambiguous. But at the personal level, I don't know how vital it is. Like in say in 20 years and you sent, or right now you send an email to someone that has something embarrassing, and 20 years later you found out that one of your friends had read it, you don't really get mad or anything, you laugh because of
it. So it probably depends who. I'm sure Bill Clinton can get into trouble.
But you see what I mean, like the general public doesn't have its exactly vital information. Now I can see the application for government and business, but I don't know if it'd be worth it to, like, as you said, to implement such a big system like cell phone towers and stuff like that for everyone, because not everyone necessarily needs 100% security.
So I'll give you an example where maybe it is a useful thing, or maybe not, and then you guys can judge, because at the end you will have to judge these issues because they are coming for society. There's a push in around the world, in part of North America and in Canada, of having your health record on the internet with good security of cryptography. Reason for this is if you go to your doctor in different doctor in different cities, they can communicate just with the internet, sending your thing, their file. Or if you suppose that you take the car and you're going skiing and through mountain at the weekend, you are in a car accident, rescue people are arriving, you have your tag and they can find your, if you're allergic to anything, so they don't kind of put you in more trouble than what you are in. So very useful to have your health records on the internet. Now the problem is this, is that if there's not good cryptography, people can go and snoop at it. So how much does it matter? But it does matter, because as things like genome research increase, in years to come, your own genome might well be completely on, kind of on file. People will know what kind of disease you want. And suddenly you decide, oh, what about insurance? I'm changing job and I want to be an insurer by this different company. The company says, oh, your genes are good, so we'll take you. Oh, your genes are here, so we'll give you a tax because you have these kind of genes. And some health or insurance companies, they're there to make money. You have to take care of your privacy. So there, that can become very important.
So really it's going to be where, at which point does everyone need perfect security?
Exactly. And it's a hard one, because there are things, like, quite often I make the story when I think about using the internet about my credit card number. So my credit card, if we build a quantum computer and 20 years, and suddenly people find my credit card number, I don't really care, because it will have changed by then and kind of gone. And if people look at what I bought with my credit card, it doesn't bother me. I'm like, I don't care. I feel a bit more queasy about
allowing this to happen. Although I can see usefulness also.
So there are lots of social ramifications of all these technologies. But I'm just looking at the time here, and I think we're pretty much out of time. So what I'd like to do is thank Ray for these fantastic answers and wonderful stories.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for all of your fantastic questions and your engagement. And I'd like to welcome you to come back to the next Black Hole Science Cafe. And in the meantime, you can check out Perimeter Institute's website, which has all kinds of great public lectures on topics like this, quantum information theory, and a wide variety of other really cool topics. Also, there's write-ups on what we research and so on and so forth. So check out our website, and thank you again for coming out, and we'll see you again. Sorry, I don't mean to sound so formal, but we're sort of taping this, and we're going to put this on the internet. So we're going to kind of like end it at an hour, you know? So really, thank you very much.